The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
Good morning, everyone, on this April 1st, 2011, April Fool's Day, I suppose, for some. Celeste Headlee is on assignment. She won't be here today, but you'll see her next week. On this Friday, we're going to go to Japan in this hour and focus on the deteriorating and frustrating developments that surround the Fukushima Daiichi power plant in northern Japan. Tens of thousands have been evacuated. Some people fear they may never return home. And this morning, we have the story of one such family. It begins in a sports hall in Yamagata, which houses refugees. And the BBC's Roland Burke is talking to the family of a retired postman, Noriyoshi Akimoto. He's here with two of his sons, their wives, and four of his grandchildren. They get food twice a day at the facility. Every night it's lights out early. And they left their home just 7 miles from Fukushima in such a hurry that Nori didn't even have time to grab his false teeth.
What do you think the future holds for your family?
For myself, I'm all right because I'm getting old and I don't know how much longer I will live. But when I think about the kids, I feel very sorry for them. So that's why we decided to escape as far away as possible.
Do you think you're going to be able to go home?
No. I just hope we can go back to my hometown. I just hope.
Outside, Mr. Okamoto's grandchildren play badminton to pass the time. Parents Munaihiro and Mayumi say the only information they've had about the power company's struggle to stabilize the reactors has been from the television.
The bosses of TEPCO have been apologizing on TV. Is that apology enough?
When I look at the news, I see the chairman apologizing and bowing to us. But his words do not reach my heart. I think that this apology is not good enough. Of course we were angry, but now it is disgust more than anger. I really wish they had told us the truth.
When the tsunami happened, they must have known it would be dangerous. My friend saw a policeman wearing a mask the next day. That was before they gave the warning to us. It's a disgrace.
It's the BBC's Roland Burke with the story of a family in Yamagata, which is about 7 miles from the Fukushima plant. Joining us now, we have from the New York Times, Ken Belson, who's a reporter for our partner, has lived in Japan for 12 years. He's back now covering the emergency. Ken, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, as we hear in those voices, the disaster and the aftermath that's still very present in Japan has worked its way into the culture and just day-to-day rituals of virtually every family. Normally, today would be a day for celebrating a new job. It's a traditional April 1st entrance day, it's called. How is this tradition being changed by the aftermath of the earthquake and tsunami?
Well, it's more than just jobs. The fiscal year starts on April 1st. The school calendar starts on April 1st. Companies as well have all these new hires, hundreds and sometimes thousands per company. We don't really have an equivalent like that in the States where everything kind of resets. It's kind of a national auld lang syne on March 31st, and then we start again today. But now there's a mood of energy conservation. There's a self-restraint going on. And so a lot of companies have canceled their traditional ceremonies they would normally have in big auditoriums or hotels. This is also a time, first couple weeks of a new job, where you go out drinking with your new colleagues every night, maybe twice or three times a night, depending on the company, and really start your bonding process, because companies in Japan assume when they hire you that you're going to be working there for a very long time. Hmm. So all that has sort of been very much muted this year and probably well into the year, especially as in the case of Tokyo, we have these rolling blackouts, which has also curtailed a lot of economic activity.
And how is this sort of concern about the future and uncertainty borne maybe even more keenly by the younger generation, who already had questions about the Japanese economy because of the difficulties of the last decade and now undoubtedly have even more?
Yeah, it's been when I came to Japan originally in 1988, there were far more jobs than there were applicants. And then through the 90s, as the economy started to sag, it reversed. And to the point where now college graduates are really scrambling for fewer and fewer jobs. The economy isn't growing the way it was those years. And the population is also declining. So a lot of businesses have curtailed new hiring. And as a consequence, these jobs become even more valuable. The problem really is not this year for a lot of college graduates. It's the current seniors who are going to be going into their last year and looking for jobs next year, because undoubtedly the economy is going to take a hit because of all of the problems that they've just had. So it's really going to linger into next year easily, and maybe even the year after that.
You know, we've heard lots of stories of bonding on the part of the Japanese, who are known for an ability to mobilize solidarity in times like these. But yet, if I think about the 12 years that you spent in Japan, your whole experience there chronicles an extraordinary transformation of going from an economy that could do no wrong to feeling the sort of slippage in the 90s and early part of the turn of the century to now a sense of maybe there's no bright future ahead. That's an extraordinary reversal.
Yeah, the arc of it strikes me even more now. I think when I lived here through 2004, you sort of lose sight of that. There were a lot of comparisons in the earlier part of this last decade. Well, Japan is turning into Switzerland. It's a very nice place to live. It's still very wealthy. It's safe. They produce premium products. But it's not a hard-charging economy anymore. And now there's an extra sort of page turned here where the future looks a lot cloudier. And in a very practical sense, obviously rebuilding part of the country, but also the whole notion of scrapping nuclear power as a viable force. You know, 30% of the country's energy comes from it. It's not an easy thing to replace. And yet they're going to have to make some serious decisions about how to fortify the other 50-some-odd plants that they have. There were already plans for another 10 or so reactors to go up, so those are now thrown into question. And when you have something as fundamental as the energy supply being questioned and retooled, that will have ripple effects all through the economy.
Is there an acquaintance who said to you something that particularly stands out as emblematic of all these changes?
That's a good question. I'm married to a Japanese woman, and so I speak both to her and to her family quite a bit. You know, the Japanese are, I think it's still kind of raw right now. In the story that we had in today's paper about new hires, I tried to draw out young people on the topic. And I think right now, they are, some are capable of thinking beyond the loss of work and so forth, or the questions about their jobs. But
it's still raw. Ken Belson, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, 12 years in Japan, an extraordinary story of transformation, even in the wake of the tsunami and earthquake.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.